Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This podcast is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. I have we're going to dip into the archives. I'm going to talk about some videos that I watched recently, including a box set, which has kept me from watching other new releases or reissues on a DVD and Blu-ray. And then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching this week. So hope everybody is doing well. Hope everybody's staying cool, especially this past week. I've been and the lack of new films that's happening on this show over the summer is because I'm directing a show that opens in July. I've mentioned it a couple times. Indie Bard Fest's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream is going to be happening in the Outdoor Theater at Arts for Lawrence on July 21st through the 24th. And you can go to Indie Bard Fest for all the information there, indiebardfest.org. So I'm directing A Midsummer Night's Dream. So that's part of the reason why I've not been able to attend screenings in the evenings, because my rehearsals are in the evening. So anyway, well, I appreciate everyone's patience on that. And, you know, you can hear other film podcasts like The Film Yap and Medium Cool and the other guys at the men and women at the Indiana Film Journalists Association. So there you go there. Now, dip in a great excuse to dip into the archives when you have a show as long as this. You can dip into the archives. June 13th is the birth date of actress Mary Wicks, and one of my favorite That Ladies, now named Committed to Memory. And it's just a great excuse to dip back into the archives and a fun interview I did with Steve Taravella, who wrote a biography on Mary Wicks called Mary Wicks, I Know I've Seen That Face Before. So let's replay that now. Enjoy. Steve, to start with, tell me your first pop culture encounter with Mary Wicks.
Wow, that's a good question. I guess I remember seeing her as Miss Cathcart, the nosy, man-hungry neighbor in the old Dennis the Menace TV series. And I was just delighted with the energy that she brought to that. She was an annoying character by any measure, but there was something really lovable about her, wasn't mm-hmm. there? So that was late 50s and early 60s. That's probably the first time I remember being conscious of her.
Okay. Mine was, I did a stage production of The Man Who Came to Dinner when I was in high school. And what has become practice for me is that, you know, once I get done with a play, I tend to, if there is a film version, I tend to seek it out just to watch. And, of course, she played the nurse in that. And, man, first off, they're like, well, these are grown-ups doing this, not teenagers. But she was just on it. And then from then on, I think especially with a career like hers, you see her pop up in other things, whether it's 20 years old or recent, and she becomes That Lady. And then there's, I think, a rite of passage when finally as a fan you have her name committed to memory. Was that the case with you?
Well said. I think that's a nice description of the kind of affection she engenders in people. And it's funny that you mentioned The Man Who Came to Dinner, because that was really a career-defining role for her. It was her first big Broadway role. She originated that part in the George S. Kaufman show, was the only stage performer from the production to be cast into film, which was her first major film. And then she went on to do other versions of it in television and radio, and sort of felt that part of Miss Preen was hers, and in fact sometimes resented those occasions when other actresses were cast in the role. What part did you play?
Oh, it was my first high school role. I was one of the convicts invited over for dinner. Yeah, so
the show still It still holds up all these years later, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's fun. You know, well, guests, annoying guests who stay too long, that's universal. There is no fad.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I guess, how did the book come about for you?
Well, I didn't set out to write Mary Wick's biography, to be sure, but I had, as a journalist, always wanted to write a biography. And I found myself some years ago in a position where I could take about a year out of the workforce and work on a book. And I, some years before that, had always wanted to interview Mary, assuming I would write a magazine profile of her, because really she worked with everybody who was anybody, and I felt certain she'd have interesting stories to tell. So I started with her. I thought, well, let me look into it and see if her life was interesting enough to justify a book, you know, a book-length treatment, because really it might not have been. And I quickly decided it was. She had a fascinating life. The original Mary Poppins, which many people didn't know, mm-hmm. the animator's model for Cruella de Vil in you know, in Disney's 101 Dalmatians, the work she did with Orson Welles in the 1930s and the groundbreaking Mercury Theater Company production. Those were all really, you know, and those three examples, TV, radio, and film right there. Mary worked across the spectrum. And then when I realized that she was also Lucille Ball's closest friend for 30 years and part of that circle of you know, mid-last century comic performers, it just opened up other doors, and I decided, yeah, there really is enough here for a book, and approached the people who were managing her estate, who were a little apprehensive at first because Mary was quite a private person, but in the end gave me the support I needed to go ahead.
I would say it seemed like the biggest challenge besides as you mentioned, but I mean, finding peers of hers that were still around. Still alive.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I approached that rather methodically. I interviewed in the end almost 300 people, but plotted them out by age and started trying to reach those who were in their later years, essentially in hopes of catching them. And I missed some. I mean, I did find quite a lot of people in their 80s and 90s who worked with Mary when she was young, or who knew her as a girl in St. Louis, including the girl who played marbles and dolls with Mary on the streets of St. Louis as a 5- and 6-year-old. But I also missed a lot of people, and missed them sometimes by almost comical measure. I mean, I remember phoning one woman in St. Louis who I was very eager to speak to, but the woman who picked up the phone said, oh, I'll have to call you back. I'm running out to her funeral right now. It was that kind of thing where, you know, by days or weeks, I missed some. It was sort of playing detective, you know, to catch people while they're able to share stories, because you really want those stories of someone's youth.
Mm-hmm. And what was her youth like?
I'd say she was raised in a rather repressive, well, maybe that's unfair to say right off the bat. I'd say she was raised in an almost Victorian conservative community in St. Louis, in a very traditional household. She was raised Episcopalian and raised to believe that church and faith and family were everything, and those are tenets that she carried with her whole life and that shaped a lot of her outlook on things. Church was always a very important part of her life. Even as an adult, she was a very active member of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills. She volunteered at hospitals. But I would say that that in some ways it was a repressive upbringing as well, and that shaped her too. Yet she remained very fond of St. Louis, and your listeners in Indiana might appreciate, of the whole Midwest in general. Mm-hmm. And in her later years, she even considered leaving Southern California and retiring back to St. Louis, where she grew up.
Does the city, I mean, is there a following with her in the city today? I mean, is there a street named after her? Is there still a legacy about her with the city?
Boy, that's a good question. In some circles, I would say yes. I mean, we have to remember that Mary now has been dead for what? She passed in 1995, so it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
There's not a street named after her. Boy, that would be nice. But your question reminds me that there is a star on the St. Louis Walk of Fame in Universal City. In Universal City, just outside of St. Louis proper. Mm-hmm. And she's there along with other famous St. Louisans, Betty Grable, Agnes Moorhead, Vincent Price, who was a very close friend of hers from her youth. Well, I think the last thing I would say to that question is, because she performed so many times at the very large, popular outdoor theater there, the Muni, officially the St. Louis Municipal Opera, she does have a following there among people who follow the performing arts. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what got her the bug to become an actor?
Well, I think Mary, who was decidedly unattractive from young, looked for ways to stand out and endear herself to people when maybe expectations of what a woman should look like or how a woman should behave were rather rigid, and she found it hard to succeed in that kind of setting. But when Mary was on stage, which she began essentially in Job's Daughters as a young girl, she always got a great reaction from the audience, and I think, like a lot of performers, thrived on that laughter and that feedback from people. It really gave her a boost of energy and confidence, and in the end, she decided to make that her career. That wasn't what she set out to do, I should say. She set out to study law. I mean, Mary was incredibly smart and clever and followed current events and enjoyed intellectual pursuits, but in the end, she didn't study law, and she didn't pursue a career in law. And some theatrical productions at the Little Theater in St. Louis persuaded her that, yeah, she could make a career of this, or try to. Mm-hmm. I suspect that her success at it surprised her as much as anybody early on.
And I know she wound up doing a lot of repertory theater on the East Coast, which was, you know, at that part of the 20th century, turns out to be great training for an artist.
You're absolutely right. It's hard for people today to appreciate how important those summer theaters were during those years. But places like the now called the Berkshire Theater Festival, but then the Berkshire Playhouse and other theaters in Cape Cod and in the Northeast during summers when people wanted to get where it was cooler and where air conditioning, because they were living where air conditioning wasn't so common, theaters were a big part of people's social life, and Mary did exceptionally well. She did well on stage in the sense that many, many reviews from local papers that I looked at, if they cited one particular performer, it was often Mary they singled out as being exceptional in the cast. Mm-hmm. And she did well off stage. She really made some lifelong friendships in those theater troupes, people who... she carried with her for the rest of her life.
And also the fact that they were almost at times banging out a play a week.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
To be, and you're rehearsing one show in the morning and maybe another show in the afternoon, and then you're doing a performance that night. And, you know, that's something you got to, you hope you're able to pass on, or at least let younger artists know that's how, at one time, that's how it's done. And in some cases, it still is.
In some cases, it is. You're right. There are a few theaters that still try that. I think it must be exhausting for the performers, but one thing about Mary to keep in mind is, she loved hard work. I mean, she had this work ethic that was just incredible. It's almost as if it wasn't hard and tough and difficult, it wasn't worth doing. Mm-hmm. So Mary rose to every challenge. She wasn't ever somebody who looked for the easy way out. And I think she really enjoyed those theatrical experiences early in her career.
When did she make the trip down to Broadway?
1939 was her first big Broadway show, and that was The Man Who Came to Dinner. So Mary was 29 when she first appeared as Miss Preen. And she at first was staying in boarding houses in Manhattan for young single women. And then as the run of that show progressed, she had saved enough where she was able to get her first small apartment to herself in Greenwich Village and stayed in New York until the mid-1950s before the lure of television and a perhaps more constant paycheck brought her to Southern California, where she lived the rest of her life.
And it was it the trip to California that she solidified the kind of that lady status?
Bat lady? What do you mean, bat lady?
The character that you recognize. You don't know her name, but you recognize her face. Oh, it's her. It's that lady.
That lady. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I would say you're right, because the parts that she got when she first arrived in California were not big starring parts. So they were the secondary roles that people might remember her from. So she was, for instance, in short order, the nurse with Betty Davis in Now Voyager. And many people today still remember that part. Mm-hmm. Wonderful comic relief, comic timing in a melodrama that was otherwise, of course, Betty Davis's picture. Yeah. And from there, she went on to many other memorable parts, a lot of the Doris Day pictures at Warner Brothers, some with Danny Thomas. And she really enjoyed those. And of course, then White Christmas, which many people know her most from now today.
Right. Actually, we'll get to that. But yeah, she even did an Abbott and Costello film, which I forgot about.
Yeah, she did. Are you an Abbott and Costello fan?
There used to be I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and there was a channel. It was a TV station in Detroit, and every Sunday morning they'd show an Abbott and Costello movie. So I've probably seen all of them several times.
Oh, how funny!
Yeah.
Well, I had not seen an Abbott and Costello picture in years before I began researching this, and I'd kind of forgotten how talented they really. I mean, I guess I didn't fully appreciate. What a great performing duo those fellows were. And Mary with them was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And she loved that. Whodunit was the movie.
Right. So you mentioned White Christmas. So, I mean, at the very least, Mary Wicks is a part of everybody's, for many people, a part of their Christmas tradition when watching that movie every year. So there, and that's, a lot of people can't say that as far as their legacy.
You're right. And for that, I think she was always grateful because, A, Christmas as a holiday was very special to her, partly because of her faith and partly because of what family meant to her. And B, Mary often felt that she was overlooked in the industry. And White Christmas was, if nothing else, a reminder once a year that she was part of Hollywood during an important time of output there. And she also just liked the film and the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It comes up every year and people ask about her. I've spoken several times at the American Film Institute at Christmas when they screen that in introducing the film. And I love the reaction the film gets now, what, 60 or something years after it was originally screened?
Exactly.
It still has a place in American pop culture. And Mary would be thrilled to see that she's still part of that.
There is a moment I have, and this, I always think of this for all character actors everywhere, although my wife has an MFA and she says all actors are character actors, but that's, you know, she's the smart one. But when she plants one on Bing Crosby, I have this image of character actors everywhere just standing up and cheering because the that guy or the that girl got to smooch a star. And it's one of my favorite moments in film.
Yeah, that's nice to hear you say. I think she might say something similar. And I share an anecdote in the book about how the scene immediately following that, where he comes in quickly for a second kiss very playfully,
yep,
and catches her off guard, was something that was simply ad-libbed on the set. But the director, Michael Curtiz, decided it worked well enough to keep it in.
Yeah, because it was, I mean, it was sincere. It's funny. But and the fact that Bing Crosby didn't repel, that means a lot for you know, certain insecure artists that we all have inside of us.
Well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, how did she get the friendship going with Lucille Ball?
Well, I think they were women who had, in the first place, simply a lot in common. They were the same age. They were only 1 year apart. They both had an innate comic sense about life. They looked at things through an unconventional lens. They both liked to perform in front of people. They could both be rather severe and harsh at times. I mean, Mary, for all the wonderful things about her, didn't have a lot of warm, fuzzy edges to her, and neither did Lucille Ball. They met in the late 1940s on a television show when they were both guest starring in the same segment, and just formed a natural friendship. They lived rather close to each other, and Mary was as much a part of the Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz family as anybody for a very long time. I would say probably less so when Lucille Ball married Gary Morton. But for 30 to 35 years, they really were extremely close. I mean, Lucy Arnaz describes Mary as absolutely her mother's closest friend. And she was at the home all the time. She was there for holidays. She traveled with Lucy. She bopped in and out of the house as if it was her second home. And they had a genuine affection for each other and just really enjoyed each other's company. In fact, it was Lucy Arnaz who gave the eulogy at Mary's funeral.
And I'd say, was the first time she appeared on Lucy's show, she was the dance instructor?
You're right.
Okay.
Yes. Mary appeared, she was one of Lucille Ball's favorite guest stars and appeared in 22 or 23 different episodes of various Lucy projects. But the first one was, in fact, the episode of I Love Lucy called The Ballet, where she was the severe, no-nonsense ballet instructor. Abba, Abba,
yes.
Abba.
I say, was that whole site, I mean, how, let me try again. That whole dance class, I'm assuming that, how much of it was scripted and how much of it was improvised on the spot, or at least in rehearsal?
I'm really glad you asked that, because people often assume that so many things in I Love Lucy, because of how hilarious and spontaneous they seemed, were ad-libbed. But it's important to, for the reputations of those writers who worked so hard, to point out that no, absolutely not. Very little was ad-libbed. And in that segment, nothing was ad-libbed. Everything was rehearsed and scripted and written down. And they performed it exactly as the final script was. So when Lucy gets her leg caught in the bar, for your listeners who might remember that, that was scripted. That wasn't Lucy during filming slipping or anything. And every part of it was written out. And the spontaneity that came across on screen just really speaks to the talent of the two women.
You mentioned the fact that she was on several episodes of the series. I mean, in all the incarnations of the series. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever watched Columbo when you were younger.
Oh yeah.
So it cracked me up when, you know, you would have you'd have somebody like Jack Cassidy or Robert Culp return as a different character, and I'm like, no, that's a bad court system. Why are you letting him out? So you're like, wait, why is the dance instructor now working as a clerk? What, she lost her job because she's that recognizable. She's that lady. So
yeah. I love how you look at that, and I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of Columbo. But it kills me to turn on a Columbo rerun and see Jack Cassidy again.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. But I'm also glad you mentioned that, because of the many, many television performances that Mary gave. Honestly, one of my very favorites is an episode she did of Columbo. She played a nosy landlady who basically distracts Columbo with inane, meandering conversation when he's trying to get clear, quick answers from her as to her observations of some murder. And she does it so well, and she's so amused, and you believe that woman, that character. And it was a rather long scene.
Well, sure.
And I just loved it, absolutely loved it. Anybody who might not remember the woman we're talking about, because we're doing radio and TV and you're not able to show clips, you can find that episode online. I believe it was called, I want to say The Last Frame, as in picture frame, something like that. But if they Google Mary Wicks and Columbo, it'll come up and you'll see
there
it. It's just a wonderful performance she gave.
And now that you mentioned that, I want that character and Columbo to be in a production of Love Letters. It'd be 3 hours, but it'd be fun. So.
You're right.
So, I mean, and I know Mary was constantly working. The thing about being a supporting actor or that person was, you know, you went to where the work was. You didn't, you know, whether it was the stage or TV or movies. And you know, in the middle part of the century, if you were a movie star doing television, that meant your career was over. Now, things have changed, obviously, in the last couple decades or so. But, you know, she had that thing of being able to bounce from one thing to another. But as I read in your book, she also wrote letters to producers, right, to just remind them that she's still around?
Yeah, which in some ways is very sad that somebody of her stature who did so much felt the need and, in fact, perceived an actual need. It wasn't a misperception that she had to constantly remind casting directors who she was and that she was there. But part of that, I think, comes from, well, as I say, genuine need to work and keep her face in front of producers and casting folks. But part of it was surely that she was, for her entire life, a single woman who supported herself, a working woman. She never made enormous salaries, not some of the salaries that maybe today's popular actresses would get, and, you know, and wasn't a top tier. And maybe in some years was paid less than a man would be paid for the same thing. So she really, she needed to work. A lot of it was financial. And because her family had suffered so much in St. Louis during the Depression year, she was also terribly insecure about money and finances, mm-hmm. Much more so than even actors who were regularly insecure, where's the next job coming from, kind of a thing. No, Mary was always frightened of not having enough money to live on.
Hmm. Shifting gears a little bit, I didn't know this until I read the book, and I was so excited to hear that that lady, that a supporting character, got to play, I think, one of the more challenging roles in American theater. But she was in a production of The Glass Menagerie. How did that come about?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? How many people would think she could be effective at that? And yet those who saw it say she absolutely was. It came about because of the affection that I described earlier that Mary had for St. Louis in general and her alma mater, Washington University. She kept in touch with many people at the school. On occasion, she contributed funds to help the theater focus of the school grow and worked with the head of the drama department there to find something that would bring her back as a performer in residence or teacher in residence. She actually did teach a couple of classes there in the theater arts. And they came up with that one. And it is surprising because not many people would perceive Mary as maybe skilled at conveying the kind of pathos and neuroses and extreme seriousness that character needs to convey. But she did. And maybe it was the St. Louis nature of it that spoke to her, that, you know, the play happens to be set in St. Louis, mm-hmm. or the affection she had for the playwright, Tennessee Williams. I don't know, but I know she wanted to do it. She pushed for that. Surely, I think part of it is she wanted to show casting directors outside of St. Louis that she could do more than maybe the meandering landlady on Columbo, you know?
Right, of course.
Yeah. And she did. She did have some other interesting dramatic parts.
Is there any footage of that performance anywhere?
No, there's not. Not that I have found. The university doesn't have any, and I wasn't able to identify anybody who happened to take sort of home movies of it. So,
right.
No.
Well, worth a shot.
Yeah.
And I know, of course, we're going in some form of chronological order, but I know it was cool to see her get a resurgence in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, because how many people get to have a resurgence late in life? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Mary was born in 1910, so, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when the Sister Act pictures came up, for instance, you know, she was approaching 80.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's exactly what did happen, a resurgence. And I would push it back even a little before Sister Act, the picture that she did directed by Mike Nichols, Postcards from the Edge.
Yep.
probably set her on a higher profile path for the last number of years of her life. She loved doing that picture. It introduced her to new, younger audiences, put her opposite some wonderful performers like Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine and Annette Bening. And she had a great experience with that. But then, yes, the sister act pictures, which, to be honest, when I describe Mary to young people who might not know her from some of the things you've asked me about, I mentioned that because many of them remember more vividly the Whoopi Goldberg films,
right.
Sister Act, and yeah.
Well, that, and she has two nun franchises on her resume.
That's a great way to say it.
It's true.
You're right. She did the Sister Act pictures and absolutely the Trouble with Angels pictures. And that's now what I'm going to start calling those, the two nun franchises. Yes.
Well, and wasn't it in the Troubles series that I think there were a couple things that she had to do? And I thought the story is, of course, you always tell a director, when told, can you do something? You always say yes, even if it's not true.
Right.
And I think wasn't one of them swimming and the other was driving a bus?
Yeah. I don't think the driving a bus was a problem, although you're right, she didn't know how to do it.
Okay.
But they could pretty much work around that. But the bigger problem was the swimming pool, because there was a scene where she was called upon to jump into the water in full nun habit and quote-unquote rescue two difficult teenage girls at this Catholic school who'd been horsing around in the water. And Mary, who honestly told the producer and director, Bill Fry, in advance that she didn't know how to swim.
Oh, okay.
Had also told them that she was taking lessons all during the production so she'd be ready for that scene. And the studio, Columbia, paid for her to take lessons at the YWCA so that she would be up for that. And then comes the day of shooting, and Mary just couldn't go in the water.
Oh.
And she offered up all these excuses to the producer as to why she couldn't go in. She was afraid. She didn't want to tell them she hadn't taken the lessons. At heart, Mary was really a very honest, ethical person, and it must have killed her to lie about this.
Mm-hmm.
But she did, in fact, lie, not because she didn't want to take the lessons, but because she feared going into the water would reveal to everybody on the set that she wore a special elastic band on one of her arms to control lymph drainage from having had breast removed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was late 1960s, and women with breast cancer were not as open about it as they are today. She was terribly afraid of losing work, being branded as unhealthy and damaged goods, and somebody who wouldn't be reliable on a set because of health needs. So she went through hoops in that production and others to keep from everybody involved the news of her breast cancer and the operation. So the producer had to very hastily find a stuntman who was Mary's size, who could quickly don that outfit and get in water and do that scene. So when viewers now see the nun from behind going into the water, that's not Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mary is shown from the front, in the water, there are two two members of the film crew on either side of her underwater holding her up for that and then quickly walking her out as soon as the director got the shot.
But just for the record, gang, that guy cannot kiss Bing Crosby. So that's, and he can't do the Glass Menagerie, so take that.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, I know near the end of her career, I mean, near the end of her life, she had a nice 1-2 punch with Little Women and then to be the voice in a Disney film in Hunchback of Notre Dame. How did those come about?
Well, Little Women was a story that Mary had loved since she was a little girl, quite honestly. So I think she must have just absolutely loved being offered that film. It's not anything that she pursued or went for or made happen. It was just a role that was offered to her. Ironically, it was offered to her after it was offered to Katharine Hepburn, who was in the original 1930s version. certainly the only time in Mary's career she received a role because Katharine Hepburn turned it down. That was a difficult film for her because it required a lot of location work in Canada during the winter. Mm. Mary was rather frail at that time. Her sight had deteriorated quite badly. She had trouble getting around. She was sort of isolated on the set, which it was mostly a younger crew. She didn't know people. I would say that was not a terribly pleasant experience for her, even though she enjoyed the story. Whereas Hunchback of Notre Dame was really wonderful for her because it enabled her to show that voice work was something she could do. Mm-hmm. And that meant she wouldn't have to go to stage sets and navigate cables on the floor with her poor eyesight and
right.
And confront stairs and stages and things. So voice work at the end became more important to her. And unfortunately, while the taping experience was really nice for her and she was paid well for it and enjoyed it, the filmmakers needed to have some of her lines redone very routinely after everything was in the can, so to speak. But Mary had just passed away.
Right.
So they turned to a few other people who they thought might be able to mimic Mary's voice rather than re-dub the entire role of the film. And the actress Jane Withers did it. And I think people now who watch the film really would have, immense trouble discerning Mary's voice from Jane Withers as Mary in those few scenes. There were about three scenes where Jane did that.
Right. And well, and what those films have in common, kind of what we were talking earlier with White Christmas is, you know, every generation has their Little Women. I know PBS is putting out a new version of Little Women this year. You know, it seems like every decade there is, you know, a BBC masterpiece, PBS, what have you, of classic literature. And for everybody, she's going to be a part of their, you know, for a lot of people, that is their Little Women. So she's a part of that. And of course, you know, her voice is on a disc somewhere in millions of homes for kids. And that's not a bad legacy to have.
Yeah, you're right. That's a nice way to look at it. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just curious, when was the last time you were channel surfing and you came across her on the TV?
Oh, that's a good question, and I can answer that really quickly. Now Voyager was shown very recently on the Turner Classic Movies, I think. And I did stop and watched even more than the scenes that Mary's in because I think it's just a wonderful picture. Have you seen Now Voyager?
It's been a long time, and now that you've brought it up, I'm going to have to go down to the basement and grab it. I tend to have stuff on disc as opposed to DVR or streaming. So, but yeah, I'll be watching that again. I think the last thing I saw was White Christmas because it was December. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a personal favorite of her work that is your go-to?
Well, I think people, smile when I say that of all of her TV work, I really do like that Columbo episode. It just captures so much of her in one scene. And there's also one episode of Here's Lucy, in the Here's Lucy series where Mary plays a nurse
yep.
to Lucille Ball in the hospital that just cracks me up every time. And, but also I do like some of Mary's serious roles. She played a scientist in an episode of Kolchak, sort of a supernatural TV mystery in the mid-70s that was really good.
Darren McGavin.
But film-wise, exactly. Okay, so you know that.
Yeah, Night Stalker. Yeah, of course. I think that's,
I
think that's on MeTV right now on a regular basis. I'm sorry, can you continue? I think we've talked a lot about, and people know her maybe for her her comedic work. What are some of the more dramatic or, because, I mean, she practically did every genre, if I remember right.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she even did musicals on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And she just loved performing. And even the radio pieces brought her a lot of pleasure. And she took them very seriously and she worked in every medium. Most of her work was comic, but not, I wouldn't say, for those who don't know her, I wouldn't say slapstick or farce. No, she just brought sort of a comic energy or a comic element to a serious film. There was something. Oh, have you seen How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon?
Long, long time ago.
Yeah. Well, it's the only movie in which Mary gets drunk. And she plays drunk so well, and maybe because it's so so atypical for her,
mm-hmm.
That you know the unexpected nature of it makes it even more entertaining. But I really thought she did a spectacular job in that, and some of the nasty parts that she played just a really bitter landlady in something called Fate is the Hunter, a movie with Suzanne Pleshette and Glenn Ford about an investigation into a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And that sticks in my mind too. On the sweet side, there were, you know, the Doris Day movies on Moonlight Bay and By the Light of the Silvery Moon. Those are really memorable too.
I also remember. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to offer just one more because you're
Please.
Asking for serious ones.
Sure.
I realized there was something in the early 1980s called Touched by Love with Deborah Raffin. Where Mary played a teacher's aide. It was one of two movies that she did with Deborah Raffin for Raffin's production company. And both of them offered Mary serious roles, and I just thought they were really nice and well done. Yeah.
You mentioned she had a character that only played drunk once. And she was very particular about certain behavioral traits for her characters, right?
Yeah, you're right. There were things she didn't want her characters to do because she found them personally, morally objectionable, which meant there were roles that she didn't get. There were certain lines of dialogue she refused to say, which meant, again, there were roles she didn't get. So she could have made more money and worked even more often than she did had she not had such a strict lens through which she saw what was acceptable and what wasn't. And sometimes, you know, she really shot herself in the foot with that approach toward work because she lost some great jobs. She was offered, not just offered, but producers really wanted her for a secondary role in Mrs. Doubtfire, the Robin Williams picture
right.
with Sally Field.
Yeah.
And apparently, the final version has a lot cut out, and some of the things that were cut out were the parts that Mary had objected to. And I think in the end, she regretted not having taken that because it turned out to be a very sweet picture with nothing objectionable in it. But the original script for the character that they wanted her for had things that she didn't want to say. And even earlier than that, in the mid-1970s, she was part of a TV ensemble with Barnard Hughes called Doc.
Yep.
And it was doing very well. And Mary was a little bit full of herself with how popular this show was and demanded script approval and said she wanted not just approval over her character's lines, but lines other characters would say, so that if she found something in the script that Barnard Hughes' character, the lead, was to say that she didn't like, that she could have it removed. And the producers got so fed up with that, they fired her. It's one of the few times in her career she was fired, but not the only time that she suffered for those sort of moral proclamations she had.
And it's funny you mentioned that because another performance of hers that comes to mind was her episode, her one episode of MASH, where she was a brash talking, heavy drinking lady.
Yeah, you're right. That was a rather odd episode. It's funny, so many people remember that, and yet I think by today's standards, we cringe at it.
Yeah, we do. There's a rape joke that is said. It's not today.
Exactly. No, I mean the idea that it's funny that a woman falsely claims rape.
Yep.
You know, just feeding into these notions that women who claim such things are making it up. I don't think that would be made today.
No.
But in 1973 or 4.
Right.
That was a popular episode.
Yep. Well, I have to mention to folks the reason how we got connected. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, you can use social media for good, not for evil. there's a group of guys that I watch movies with every week when I'm able to, and we were one. Gosh, it was before the holidays. We were watching The Music Man, which she has a role as one of the cheapy ladies, one of the chicky ladies.
Exactly.
And I wrote on social media that The Music Man reminded me that I wanted to date Shirley Jones, but I wanted to go drinking with Mary Wicks, and. And that, well, after reading the biography, that's not happening. That wouldn't have happened. So, but I think because she had so many stories, and I think the MASH thing probably was also in my head that, you know, she had 1,000 stories to tell, and it would just be fun to, you know, huddle up in a corner and hear all of them. But apparently you'd be over ginger ale. But I'll take it anyway.
And then I'm glad to hear that.
And that's how you responded. So, ladies and gentlemen, it can be done use for good. So,
right. Well, I'm glad you reached out that way. And this has been really fun talking to you and to your listeners in Indiana. And please let them know if they'd like more, they can find the book on Amazon in 4 formats: hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audiobook.
And while I got you here, what else have you written?
Oh, I am a one book author. This took so many years and so much time. I don't think I'll invest time in another one.
Wow. Okay.
I did this as a labor of love. I make my living working in international development. So this was something completely done for the passion of it. And I don't think I'll do another one. But thanks for asking about that.
Doing what I can to help spread the good word. So, Steve, thank you so much for your time.
No, really appreciate it. Thank you.
That's author Steve Taravella from 2018. He wrote the book Mary Wicks, I Know I've Seen That Face Before. And, of course, Mary Wicks' birthday was on June 13th, so hopefully you took the day off. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm going to go through some videos, some films, some DVDs and Blu-rays I got to watch recently before we grab a pencil. The big collection I was looking forward to is came out from... Shout Factory. Now, a few years ago, they put out Herzog the Collection, which had 16 films of Herzog's, documentaries and features, and one of the best box sets of films I have in my collection. And some of the titles from Volume 1 include A Gear of the Wrath of God, Nosferatu, Fitzcarraldo, My Best Fiend, just Little Dieter Needs to Fly, a lot of excellent films. And you know, they're not all great, but they are all fascinating because Herzog is fascinating. And it reminded me of when you hear stories of an artist that are creating something for the first time. They have their first creation takes their entire lifetime, not just from the time they started making the item, but from the time that the artist became an artist and you know that sort of thing. So in this case, the follow up is always a much shorter because it's from the last time from the time you finished the first piece. Well, Volume 2 is out. There were 16 films in Volume 1. This one has 11 and it has a lot of the stuff, a lot of films, features and documentaries, and a lot of short films, a lot of short documentaries, just so you know about that. It is a step down from Volume 1 because of some of the great titles I've already mentioned, but there's still some fascinating films in this collection. So if you're a Herzog fan, definitely worth getting this. It's just not as monumental as Volume 1, and it's just what happens when you kind of put a greatest hits. It's one thing when you do greatest hits from one era, but this one, it ranges from 1968 till about the 90s. So 11 films, which include Signs of Life from 1968, of German soldiers sent onto a small island in Greece as far and away from battle and how that becomes more damaging to them than actual war. From 1974, The Great Ecstasy of Woodcarver Steiner, about a ski jump. And it's funny because it looks like Werner Herzog doing Wild World of Sports, and we get to see the trials and tribulations of being a ski jumper. At times it also looks like, to borrow a line from Mystery Science Theater, the agony of defeat auditions. But also, you know, beautiful footage of the mountains and also the danger that comes with jumping, you know, flying with your skis. There's also the short film, How Much Wood Could a Woodchuck Chuck?, where Herzog follows a national cattle auction competition. Yeah. And I think he's obsessed with the sound and the rhythm and the cadence that goes with that. So it's only 46 minutes, which is, if you think about it, it could have been a full-length feature, and I think we're all the better for it. La Surfire, hope I'm saying it right, about a Guadalupe volcano that erupted in 1976. And this is also the first film, if I remember right, that has Herzog's voiceover in English. He had done some in German and other films, but this was, I believe, the first one. And then we have God's Angry Man, about Dr. Gene Scott, an L.A. televangelist. And we see him in his on the air, off the air, in a limo, talking about his businesses. During a live broadcast, trying to get money for whatever, you know, the church, and him not saying anything on live TV until somebody makes a pledge. Anybody, when it comes to televangelists, you know, I'm sorry, F that guy. Huey Sermon, nice change of pace, about an African-American church, and it's the sermon for the most part, the first half of this film, which happens in an inner city. We disperse it with footage of just dilapidated buildings. There's a healing portion of the church, and there's a baptism, which is a little more, for me, a little more acceptable than the healings. From 1984, The Dark Glow of the Mountains, about two gentlemen doing a mountain climb. This has voiceover. This has narration not done by Herzog, and therefore it feels like a badly dubbed kung fu film. But it's climbing two different peaks in a row, which had not been done by these gentlemen. They had done one separate, but not both. So we also have the documentary Herdsmen of the Sun, where we follow a small village south of the Sahara. Also has the kind of one of the standard Herzog shots, which happens in a lot of films, of music of the era or music of the country or classical music, with a lot of camera pans over a lot of local non-actor faces. Really cool stuff there. Yes, I'm turning pages. From 1990, Echoes from a Somber Empire, which has a journalist revisiting a Central Africa Republic where he was tortured by the government because he was accused of being a spy. So, and this September Dawn, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, has that kind of similar thing where a person who was a victim of an atrocity, in this case torture, or a POW camp, going back and visiting the scene of the crime, I guess, or the scene of the crime to them. So rumors of how this Central African Republic, that the emperor was a cannibal, and there's cover of his coronation, there's footage of him. Just a fascinating look at somebody who wants to go back to probably the worst point in their lives and revisit. Wheel of Time, dealing with the lowlands of the Ganges River. The Dalai Lama even gets a special appearance credit, which kind of makes me giggle. And I remember seeing this years and years ago, and this was my introduction to monks who make sand art. This gorgeous, unbelievably beautiful piece of sand art that takes days, weeks, months probably. And of course, when it's all said and done, they brush it away and they dump it in the river. And anyway, but it also goes with a visit, a kind of a convention, I guess, by the Dalai Lama and others that follow him. And then we end up with Wild Blue Yonder, which has some fascinating footage of astronauts and astrologists dealing with really good rocket. There's some really good rocket footage in space. There's also discussion of the Roswell United UFO tales. We see astronauts trained underwater, kind of spliced in with the Wright brothers footage. And this is all hosted, narrated by actor Brad Dourif, not Herzog. Doesn't try to sound like Herzog, but he is the kind of mouthpiece for the film. Of course, Brad Dourif, known for films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Voice of Chucky. And the only thing I can describe his appearance in this film is a combination of being the Werner Herzog mouthpiece and the guy at the bar, sitting next to you at the bar, that will not shut up. So, overall, a good collection of Herzog films, not a great collection of Herzog's films, but if you are a fan of Werner Herzog, you definitely want to get Herzog the Collection Volume 2 out on Shout Factory. New on video from IndiePix is a film called Scarf Face. There's two F's in there. And this is about the history and the politics and the drama behind, competitive eating. So, and especially, more specifically, the history of the Nathan's hot dog eating festival. So, and it's called Scarface because they borrow music from the show, and there's some publicity logos and fonts that look very similar to the 1983 Brian De Palma film. And the politics and how one of the champions, Kobayashi, has been pushed out, and how much of the league takes an athlete's money. They say athletes, not me. And what the rise and fall of Joey Chestnut and the new generation that comes before him. And, I was impressed with the amount of drama and intrigue and politics that goes on over what I think is just a disgusting display. One of my best dad moments was Emma was probably 4 or 5. And it was July 4th, and I came across ESPN that was showing the hot dog eating contest. And this particular year, I can't remember, I believe it was Joey Chestnut who blew chunks in his hand. And that grossed out Emma and said I'd never want to do a food eating contest ever. So mission accomplished. But I have to give kudos to the film for, displaying the ugly backstage dramas over probably at times an uglier display than the actual contest itself. Also from Corneth Videos is the drama called Cage Birds, where you have a lawyer battling the ancient prison system going on in Switzerland and winds up teaming up with a professional prison escape artist. And it does go down, but not as sappy in the they don't like each other from the beginning of the film, but they have to work together. So Cage Birds is out on Corneth. From Film Classics, Film Movement Classics from Taiwan, it's a fascinating drama called Vive l'Amour, about three people, some individuals and different combinations, who, unbeknownst to each other, are sharing the same apartment. We have a realtor that uses a space for late night tryst with a particular gentleman. While this is going on, they don't know that someone has stolen a key and snuck in themselves. So we see three bodies, three people almost connecting. In some cases, there's different as the film goes on, there's different combinations of the two of the three that connect. The film begins with about 25 minutes of no dialogue based on one gentleman that comes in and wants to slit his wrist and kill himself. Meanwhile, in another room, there's a couple making out. So it almost felt like a Jacques Tati film because there's minimal dialogue. But it was interesting to hear the director of this film talk about it. Won a prize at the Venice Film Festival. It was a controversial split decision, and it then played at the Singapore Film Festival, which half the audience walked out. And a quote that the director says, "If you have 100 people, 80 people might not like it, but 20 will be changed by it." And the controversy, I guess, over the display of homosexuality, there is a homosexual moment where one man kisses another while the other one is sleeping. And this caused quite a stir in Taiwan in the mid 90s. So but an intriguing character study of three folks kind of drifting and kind of coming into each other's lives. From Bayview Entertainment, a bonkers midnight movie called Ninja Badass. So, writer, director, star Ryan Harrison, and I'm hoping to get him on the show soon about this. This is the story of a loner living at home with his mom, trying to learn ninja skills from a TV organization that advertises on TV. And what happens when he falls for a girl who works at a pet shop and she is kidnapped by the same people he wants to train him to become a ninja? It's one of those where they're deliberately trying to make a midnight movie, trying to make a cult movie. And, of course, that doesn't always work. Look at Snakes on a Plane or other films. But this one heightened it takes the heightened tone of martial art films and throws it in what turns out to be small town Indiana. This film was shot in several cities around Indiana. No clue. I was pleasantly surprised by that. They mentioned Indiana in the film, and I've lived here long enough, and I thought, oh no, they shot this somewhere else. You know, like The Juror, or The Judge, or other films that are supposed. Ricky and the Flash. But it does follow its tone of being an over-the-top, kind of crazy martial arts parody or martial arts film in its own way. The film's too long. This film is about 1 hour 40, and it screams 80 minutes. And I'm sure the director, writer, producer will tell me, well, like Mozart, which notes do you take out? You could tighten it up. There's just a lot of and a lot of CG explosions and blood spurts, which is a good Mystery Science Theater fodder. It's also inexpensive to use. I understand it. It's still distracting. But it does, in a way, follow the tone of this film where, things are blown up and body parts are ripped off and. But it does follow the martial arts pattern. There are not one but two battles between our hero and our main villain, and kind of like Rocky III, if you know that pattern. So you can follow that. But think of it as Enter the Ninja meets the Trailer Park Boys. And the other part was, and this is a great tip for folks for you listening out there. I watched this at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I should have watched it at midnight. I should have had a pizza and several beers and then go and watch Ninja Badass. So keep that in mind if you go looking for Ninja Badass, courtesy of Bayview Home Video. And again, I'm hoping to get the filmmaker on the show soon. From Film Movement is a black and white drama from Bulgaria called Fear, where we have Svetla, who is a widow living in a small Bulgarian village. She lost her job when the school closed down. And she winds, while out hunting in the woods, she finds an African refugee who wants to go to Germany. And she doesn't really take him prisoner, but leads him to his home. And as time goes on, they are skeptical of each other. He speaks some English. She does not. She doesn't speak German. She doesn't speak African. And as time goes on, they're able to develop communication and a friendship. But because it's a small town and you have the really obnoxious all-male border patrol, it starts to dust up a little bit around town. But the nice chemistry between the two leads and the fact that this refugee who just wants to go to Germany makes a widow who has been a closed shell for years and years and years finally opens up. So look for Fear. I believe this was Bulgaria's entry into the Academy Awards last year. So look for Fear, courtesy of Film Movement. For you jazz fans out there, and especially jazz fans with an Indiana connection, Bix Ain't None of Them Play Like Him Yet. This is a documentary from Kino Lorber from 1981, and it's about the life and times of jazz musician Bix Beiderbecke. How old is this? Because Bix only lived till he was 28, died in 1931. And it's for an old film nerd like me, it's fun to watch documentaries from the early 80s and late 70s. They have... it's slightly bigger than talking heads. They're usually, you see a talking person sitting in a chair, or at a piano in this case. This has, like I said, this is from 1981. There's actual footage of Hoagy Carmichael being interviewed in this. And we get to hear about Bix's story, including joining a band called the Wolverines, going to Indianapolis, playing at the Indy Athletic Club, going to IU for gigs, and eventually recording in Richmond, Indiana for Jeanette Records. So if you are a music history buff or a jazz fan, definitely look for Bix. Ain't None of Them Play Like Him Yet. It's on video, thanks to Kino Lorber. Also on Kino Lorber is a drama called Charlotte, which an animated feature, and it's from the studio that brought you Loving Vincent. So there immediately you can tell the tone, the look of the animation. And this is based on the story of Charlotte Solomon, who was a German-Jewish artist, kind of coming in of age right before World War II. So in this, she's learning to draw. She's learning to love. She's also under the thumb of her grandparents and her parents. The film is produced, two of the co-executive producers on it are Keira Knightley and Marion Cotillard. Knightley does the English language version. Cotillard does the French version. And this film is loaded with voice talent. Brenda Blethyn, Jim Broadbent, Eddie Marzin, Sophie Okonedo, and Mark Strong. But we get to see Charlotte growing up, learning her craft as writing, getting older as a woman, growing into young womanhood, and also having to deal with Europe and at the rise of World War II, and didn't know anything about her work, and to borrow a phrase from Emma many, many years ago, this isn't going to end well, and sadly it doesn't. But it's beautiful animation, good use of Charlotte's actual work in real life. It's based on a collection of hers called Life or Theater, which is considered the kind of unofficial first graphic novel. So look for Charlotte if you're an animated fan. That is on Kino Lorber, as well as from Cohen Media Group is a 2013 drama called Breathe In. And this is one I had no clue this film was made. And I'm really glad I checked it out. It's from Drake Dormus, who prior had done the really understated love triangle drama called Like Crazy. That was the one with Anton Yelchin, Felicity Jones, and Jennifer Lawrence. In this one, Guy Pearce and Amy Ryan play a couple living outside New York City. They have a 17-year-old daughter. He was a touring musician, a gig musician. Now he's settled into domestic life in his house as a longtime music teacher. And part-time with the local symphony, but is trying to get an audition with one of the New York symphonies. And they bring in a foreign exchange student, played by Felicity Jones from England, and something sparks she brings a creative spark into the husband's life. Yep, you can see where this is going. And much to the film's credit, and much to Drake's credit, like what I do remember of Like Crazy, besides liking the performances, and it's a slow burn. It's not a slow film. It comes in under an hour 40, but the tension is the tension's there, but the performances and the choices are understated. So really good performances from the four actors, including I forgot to write down who played the daughter, Lauren, but yeah, really well done from everybody. So look for Breathe In from Cohen Media. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, before we grab a pencil, let's go around the horn. And just a few reminders, of course. The 19th Annual Indie Film Fest is happening. That's running at the Can-Can Cinema through June 19th. And then there are online screenings running through June 26th. So you can go to IndieFilmFest.org for all the information about those events. So go check that out. The new latest episode of You Must Remember This, close to wrapping up Erotic 80s, Kevin Costner, Sean Young talking about No Way Out and Bull Durham. Oh, I was 18 when Bull Durham came out, and yeah, Susan Sarandon, really good. And then my buddies over at Golden Globus Theater doing a lesser-known Robert Klaus film, Golden Needles. This is one with Joe Don Baker, Jim Kelly, Burgess Meredith, Elizabeth Ashley. There's Robert Klaus is the gentleman who directed Enter the Dragon and Game of Death, but we won't talk about that. But he also did Black Belt Jones. Also did a film I'd like to talk about with the Golden Globus guys called The Ultimate Warrior. No, not that guy, but it's Yul Brynner in the title role as well as Max von Sydow. I don't know if it's on video. I'm sure somewhere it's on YouTube, but, you know, you get the idea of that. So go check out my buddies over at Golden Globus and You Must Remember This. And, of course, the Film Yap, Independent Critic, Medium Cool Podcast, and other shows courtesy of the Indiana Film Journalists Association, if you would please. Thank you very much. All right. Over, let's hit the drive-ins for a little bit. Over at the Tibbs drive-in, on screen one, Lightyear and Bob's Burgers. And the first showing is at 9:30. Well, it's still a little light, but it'll, as the summer goes on, I guess. Screen two, Doctor Strange and Lightyear. Screen three, Jurassic World. Okay, that's it. And screen four, Top Gun and Raiders of the Lost Ark. That'd be fun to watch on the big screen. That's over at the Tibbs Drive-In. At the Skyline in Shelbyville this weekend, let's see. Got on June 18th, Jurassic World and Maverick, as well as Tremors. That Jurassic World and Top Gun on June 19th. June 23rd, Lightyear, free popcorn Thursday at the Skyline. June 24th, 25th. 26, Lightyear and Bob's Burgers. And then June 29th, the Indie Sensations, Crimes of the Future, as well as Pleasure. And then June 30th, Lightyear, Free Popcorn Thursday. That's over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Just a reminder, Tuesday, June 21st, 10 a.m., Hotel Transylvania. And then Friday and Saturday, June 24th and 25th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. What's Up, Doc? Peter Bogdanovich with Peter Bogdanovich film with Barbara Streisand, Ryan O'Neill, and Madeline Kahn. And then Tuesday, June 28th at 10 a.m. is Happy Feet. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you've been able to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start on Twitter, more Twitter activity than usual. So thank you to Twitterverse for, you know, putting my post up. Oh, heck yeah, writes, I watched Roadrunner this week, the Anthony Bourdain documentary. I know it was criticized for whitewashing him, but I thought it was great. That's a fan. Dave writes, halfway through Paul Schrader's The Card Counter. Now, that's a rough one. Thought it would be a feel-good Vegas comedy. Not. Dave, have you not seen any films written and or directed by Paul Schrader? No, it is not. This isn't Ocean's 11. So, Dave, I'm sorry you thought it was going to be a feel-good Vegas comedy. So now you must be punished. You should watch, what's it, Hardcore, Blue Collar, Affliction. Yeah, all of his First Reformed, that would be good. So, yeah, not huggy, not a warm, fuzzy film. NYC Cinema Confidential writes, Pink Flamingos, which is getting a Criterion Blu-ray release soon. I'm looking forward to that. Janet writes, saw Marcel the Shell with Shoes at the Indie Film Fest. Very good. And James says, check out Film Sociology. Thank you, James. The Night Watch Tapes writes, rewatches, Busting, Annihilation, Secret Honor, Killing of America, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The 11th Green, and Variety. And then the first watch was X. And then my buddy Eric gives me a gif of Empty Pockets. That means he didn't see any movies this week. It's okay, Eric. Try again next week. Kilbourne Alley, the Kilbourne Alley Band, go check out their music, writes Licorice Pizza and The Duke. Josie Alma Press, publisher of Worst Sellers, these are the things, Meatballs 3, and then asks, do you have guests on your show? I can send you an 80s teen Philic Festival book, so that might be coming in the mail for me. Linda writes Maverick and West Side Story. And I believe, yeah, that's about it. So there you go. Thank you, Twitter. Appreciate that. We go to Facebook. We go to last week's post. Stu writes, John writes, I know what you did last summer. Craig writes, Operation Mincemeat. Maveen writes, Spartacus, yes. And Kirk Douglas was the executive director. Screenplay by Dalton Trumbo. and directed by Stanley Kubrick, who was 27 at the time. Sir Laurence Olivier, Charles Laughton, Tony Curtis, and Gene Simmons, all heavyweights. Levine, I'm glad you brought this up. I made reference to Spartacus earlier this week in rehearsal for A Midsummer Night's Dream. I'm setting it in Louisiana. Not everybody's going to have accents. I think everybody having a Southern accent in Shakespeare just kind of slows it down a little bit. So the older and authoritative characters will have accents. So, and of course, in this one, a Roman film where all of the lords are English and all the slaves are Americans, especially Tony Curtis. So thank you, Mavine. Linda writes Somewhere in Time. Nancy writes The Northman. Cassie writes No Time to Die. Joe writes Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker, and Tenebrae. Mike writes, none, vacationing, working on my sunburn. Thank you, Lawrence. Monica writes, my husband, Brian, introduced me to The Untouchables. It was really good. I love some classic Sean Connery. The music was a little weird for Morricone, but it was still Morricone. That's why I loved the score to The Untouchables. That's the Chicago way. Yeah, I really, really enjoy that. I remember during lockdown, I went to the well one too many times with Emma. I showed her Bull Durham. She loved it. And it's funny, the Untouchables is also mentioned in You Must Remember This. And after watching Bull Durham, Emma told me she wanted to get into a time machine and meet 1987 Kevin Costner. And so and then we watched The Untouchables, and not the same effect. Not the same effect. By the way, Dad Film Hall of Fame, The Untouchables is definitely in that. So, yeah, and George Stone with just counting two. Really cool. All right, Taylor writes The Guilty, Downton Abbey, A New Era, and Godzilla vs. Kong, as well as Red. Abby writes The Sound of Music, and embarrassed to say this was my first viewing. Don't be, Abby. We all have those films that we just haven't gotten around to. That's the beauty of film. And hopefully, you know, your friends, relatives, or, you know, social media don't have a conniption because you finally got around to seeing The Sound of Music. Better late than never. It's okay, Abby. She also watched the Bob's Burgers movie, so there you go. Destiny chimes in, so excited for some good old goofiness. I saw Everything Everywhere All at Once, so good, also goofy fun, definitely more adult, sure. Tony writes Argento Suspiria, and I mentioned if he'd seen the remake of Suspiria, because my theory is Argento Suspiria is the song My Favorite Things, recorded by Julie Andrews. The remake is My Favorite Things, recorded by John Coltrane. Way longer, out there for different reasons. Both are perfectly acceptable in your universe. Rachel writes Mr. Bean's Holiday, Back to the Future, Grown Ups, also Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, since my son has been trying to debate who the best Spider-Man is without having seen any of them. Aren't kids great? Rachel, good luck with that. And I don't know how old your son is. You don't have to rank everything. That's the advice from film sociology, from the film podcast. Don writes Jurassic World. Wouldn't recommend it, even though I'm a fan of the original. And The Northman, 2 hours I'll never get back. All right. Sarah writes The Green Knight, visually stunning, interesting take on the legend, but lacks some of the nuance that I believe a more marginalized writer-director may have found in the story, especially with an actor of color helming the story. Thank you, Sarah. Mary writes Magical Mystery Tour. Jared writes Good Will Hunting. Christian writes Sneakers, so 90s, yes. Erica, hey, Chief, Silent Running. Yesterday's Target, Riff Tracks, The Corpse Vanishes and the Crawling Hand, Mystery Science Theater, El Santo and the Fury of the Karate Experts, House of Black Death, and Easterner Goes West, the Harold Lloyd film. All right, hold on, Chief. A few things. You watched El Santo with no riffing. I'm impressed. And Silent Running. Okay, I tell these little stories of Emma in her younger days, in their younger days. One of the early... She wasn't trying to be a hipster, but she claims, and you know, it's a strong argument, that Silent Running was better than Star Wars when it came to science fiction. So that's my Emma. Thank you, Chief. Doug writes, tell it to the Marines, Sylvia Scarlett, Nothing Sacred, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, and No Country for Old Men. Jed's always looking for first-timers. Watched Dead End, 1937, with Humphrey Bogart. Was a great watch and highly recommended. Also watched Jeff Seaman's, S-E-E-M-A-N-N's, new film Terror Trips. I highly recommend for any horror fans looking for something to watch. This was fun. So Gretchen originally wrote in the post and then later corrected The Last American Picture Show. And I'm like, you mean The Last Picture Show, right? Because there was also a 1973 film, also with Jeff Bridges, called The Last American Hero. Didn't want any confusion. So this happens a couple times every week. Rick writes Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Nikki writes The Lighthouse, High Rise, and Tombstone. And Nikki calls The Lighthouse a masterpiece. Eric, yes, I know you got nothing. We'll try it again next week. Doug writes The Prisoner of Zenda, 1937, Thor, The Dark World, and Iron Man 3. Eric writes Ghost, In the Mood for Love, and The Last Picture Show, plus Bosch Legacy, which is as good as a crime drama gets. David writes Courage Under Fire, an underappreciated Denzel Washington film, Untold, Malice at the Palace, and Saving Private Ryan. Howell writes No Time to Die. Amanda writes with pictures of the DVDs she checked out from the library. Thank you, Amanda. Shampoo, Blue Lagoon, and Blue Lagoon 2, which made me bring up the You Must Remember This episode, 1982 Sexploitation, which included Fast Times at Ridgemont High and the Blue Lagoon. Amanda also watched The Lost Weekend, To Please a Lady, as well as Jeopardy. Thank you there. Daniel writes The Private Life of Elizabeth in Essex, The Black Widow Murders, The Shadow Box, Girl Crazy, Winter Meeting, An Early Frost, and Sherlock Holmes and the Pearl of Death. Lou Harry writes Screen Time devoted to The Offer and The Orville. Marianne writes The Rise of Skywalker, so many connections to my Christian faith. Mostly we give God's love and sacrifice for each other to be connected and supportive with the common good. Thank you, Marianne. Mike writes Jurassic World. David writes both Top Guns, Jurassic World, and Season 3 of Barry. Michael writes, no films but a documentary, The Mystery of Marilyn Monroe, The Unheard Tapes. Perhaps just speculation, but hearing the voices of everyone involved and fascinating. And my response, a documentary is a film. Abdul Hakim Shabazz writes Nixon. Okay, I can't repeat it here, but there are certain lines in that film that make Abdul and I chuckle. Abdul is probably a bigger fan of Oliver Stone's Nixon than I am. It is. I love 90s bonkers Oliver Stone. And if you thought, and this was the film he did after Natural Born Killers, if you thought that was heightened of the senses, it's just as bad or just as good with Nixon, and he tries to treat Nixon like a Shakespearean tragedy character. It almost makes you feel bad for Nixon. Almost. Almost. Kim writes Blackbeard's Ghost and The Princess and the Pirate. Alan writes Cave of Forgotten Dreams. I love Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Of course, we talked about Werner Herzog earlier. I always remember my wife's review of the film, Cave Drawings and Hearts of Space Music. Phil writes, I watched Big Eyes last night. Justin writes, Wrath of Man. Kevin writes, No Time to Die and A Serious Man. Chris writes, Station Agent, love Peter Dinklage, The Hustle and The Staircase, and then added woof. Wayne writes, Kimmy with Zoe Kravitz. A little slow at the start, but then boom, roller coaster ride. Loved it. And card counter. I can't believe Martin Scorsese was a money man on this. I can't say that word. It's okay. I don't think I can, and I'm not going to. If you have to question it, you really shouldn't. decent performances, but it was downright schizophrenic screenplay. Writer couldn't decide if he wanted to write a Mammoth movie or Coming Home, so he just threw everything a wall and absolutely nothing stuck. Oscar Isaac is a great performer, but even he couldn't save it. Well, part of the reason why Scorsese was a money man is because the film was written and directed by Paul Schrader, the man who wrote Taxi Driver and The Last Temptation of Christ and Bringing Out the Dead. So there's a connection, Wayne. There you go. Oh, this is what I was talking about earlier. So Chris wrote originally The Hustle and then meant Hustler. And I thought, do you mean Hustle, which is the Adam Sandler film that just came out? Not to be confused with the Jennifer Lopez film called Hustlers. Not to be confused with the billiards movie The Hustler. Not to be confused with the Burt Reynolds cop drama Hustle. And then she writes whatever the freaking Adam Sandler movie is called. Thank you, Chris. Good sport. Friends, you got to be careful about titles because this is how you miss questions on Jeopardy or film sociology. LBO writes Maupertius. Jamie writes Crimes of Grindelwald and Encanto. Melissa writes Hustle. I know Melissa. She watched a Burt Reynolds movie. No. Eric writes My Blue Heaven. Abby writes Beetlejuice. Jay writes, wow, we watched The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and Inferno. All pretty good movies. I'd never seen them before. I know you, Jay. Do you watch all three of these in a row? Man, I hope you watch Bob's Burgers or something to cleanse your palate after that. JJ writes, How It Ends, deemed it Netflix waste of time. The Deep House, Amazon waste of time. Respect, so disappointing. I know. And A Quiet Place Part 2, as expected. Bob writes The Phantom of the Open. Andra Faye writes Downton Abbey, A New Era, and No Time to Die. Mickey writes Blackbird, loved it, and The Dressmaker, another good one. Michelle writes Jurassic World Dominion, deemed it disappointing. Marie Antoinette, Hannah, The Adjustment Bureau, and Young Victoria. Abby writes The Hate U Give and Tolkien. Pam writes Casablanca. Anthony writes Catching Up on Stranger Things. Mel writes, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. We are introducing the 7-year-old to classics from our childhood. All right. Phil writes All Quiet on the Western Front. Joan writes, oh, The Notebook. I'm homesick with COVID and needed some good old-fashioned emotional cutting. And that's the razor. I think I'll watch The Bridges of Madison County to finish the job. Hang in there, dear. Rachel writes Legend of the Naga Pearls. John writes For Love of the Game. Kurt writes Goodfellas for Saturday Night at Beltrace. The Jazz Singer for the Second Sunday Musical. This is the Neil Diamond version. Ooh. And then The Deadly Game On My Own, an interesting rendition that I remembered from HBO way back when I finally saw it again this week, courtesy of a YouTube upload, ironic given the nature of the story. Thank you, Kurt. Andy writes Barry and Stranger Things. Joanne writes Waiting from Space and Loch Ness Terror. Joe writes Operation Mincemeat and Outer Range. Robert Muggy writes, I continued celebrating the 100th anniversary of Judy Garland's birth by watching the following. The Pirate, The Clock, Present Lily Mars, Girl Crazy, For Me and My Gal, Babes in Arms, Ziegfeld Girl, In the Good Old Summertime, The Harvey Girls, and Easter Parade. Thank you, Robert. Gary writes Dreamscape, Death Watch, Rosemary's Baby, Enigma, The Satanic Rites of Dracula, The Theater Bazaar, Spike, The Importance of Being Earnest from 1952, Skyfall, Rabid, No One Hears the Scream, Asylum, Twisted Horror, and Fantasy Tales. Nick writes Star Wars, Phantom Menace, Single White Female, X, Master, Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith, Hustle, All the Pretty Horses, and Spiderhead. Kate writes Tim Burton's Dark Shadows. Robert writes The New Top Gun. Mario writes Memories of Murder. Michael writes Last Survivors, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Pride of the Yankees, and Uncharted. William writes The Many Saints of Newark and Jojo Rabbit. Diana writes, Everything Everywhere All at Once, first movie at the theater in a couple years, had a private viewing on Tuesday night. Congratulations, Diana. Welcome back. David writes, Darkest Hour. Cassandra writes, Age of Ultron. James writes, The Hot Spot. Yeah, there's Nathan Rabin does a nice write-up about the hot spot this week, so go look that up. And I did not ask for the cover. It just came that way, and I'm very happy about that. It's with Jennifer Connelly and Virginia Madsen and Don Johnson, so that's a little something for everybody. James also watched the Edward G. Ulmer sci-fi triple feature, The Man from Planet X, Beyond the Time Barrier, and The Amazing Transparent Man. Carrie writes, Uncharted. I thought it was pretty good. Mulveen writes, Mississippi Masala. Perfect for the weather we've been having. It's also out on Criterion. I bought my copy. I just haven't gotten around to it. She had to say yes, a 1933 pre-code film with Loretta Young. Finally, Prince of Foxes with Orson Welles and Tyrone Power. Teresa writes, the reboot, the female Ghostbusters and Hidden Figures. And finally, David writes a Thai film called Chocolate on Prime. Girl power, kick-ass, fight choreography. Thank you, David. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching. So hopefully you found some films that are some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. There's a couple titles in there that are on my pile, and I need to get to those. I hope I will soon. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. I want to end this week's show with a little tribute to character actor Philip Baker Hall, who died earlier this week at the age of 90. The man has 185 credits to his name, and I'm not going to rattle off the titles like I normally do. Now, I know television-wise, best known as the coffee cop on Seinfeld. He was also the crusty old man that took a friendship with Luke Dumphy on Modern Family. But and has done a lot of stuff. You have to go online. From The Rock and Rush Hour. And, of course, he was in one of Paul Thomas Anderson's regular players, which I'll get to in a moment. But two films I watched this week that are, for me, are Philip Baker Hall's best work. The first one is 1996's Heart Eight. That's Paul Thomas Anderson's first feature film. And according to legend, Paul Thomas Anderson wrote this specifically with Philip Baker Hall in mind, which is, that says something. Sidney is an aging gambler with a shady past. We're not sure exactly how far he is in the crime world, or out of the crime world to a certain degree. And he takes under his wing a young, a down-on-his-luck gambler, played by John C. Reilly, and a casino waitress who's also a prostitute on the side, played by Gwyneth Paltrow. And kind of becomes a father figure for both of them, teaching him better ways of making money through the casino and teaching her to have a little more self-esteem. Also thrown into the mix is Samuel L. Jackson, who's an up-and-coming guy working the Vegas scene, and he finds out a fairly dark secret about Sidney. Philip Baker Hall, my gosh, he was probably in his 50s when he did Heart Eight. And he has just one of those great faces, silver hair, great puffy kind of craggly face to it. And every year's on it. Every year of, and that's what Sidney has, is that every year of his doings, he has rules, he has advice that's very sound, and he has a very regimental existence until not one, not two, but three people really get inside his bubble. And it's a lovely drama. I would say it's a crime drama, but it's more than that because of the relationships between the three and then definitely the fourth person that gets involved. So, this is the film that Paul Thomas Anderson did before Boogie Nights. The one that I remember, will always remember, and I'm so happy I have this on Criterion DVD, and I hope they do a Blu-ray release, is Robert Altman's Secret Honor from 1984. I remember Siskel and Ebert raving about this film, and it's one that I remember finally renting it and sort of getting it. It's a one-man show. It is 90 minutes of Philip Baker Hall as Richard Nixon. It is not The Night Before He Resigns. I thought it was. That's sort of how I remember it. But he is home. He has a lot of booze. He has a gun. He has a lot of TV screens. He's not Elvis, but a lot of TV screens. And he's got a lot on his mind, dictating, bellowing, screaming, pleading into a tape recorder. and then asking the person who's going to transcribe it to just erase everything he just said. It's an amazing performance. For one, we haven't had prior to this, we hadn't had a one man show really since Richard Pryor's comedy films, as well as James Whitmore doing Give Him Hell, Harry. And Philip Baker Hall as Richard Nixon runs the gamut from bitter, angry, enraged, sad, confused. It's a good kind of exhaustion, is a way of putting it. I'm not going to say it's the most acting, but man, it is a roller coaster ride with Nixon. Another one of not quite Oliver Stone, where you almost feel bad for the guy. Not as much as this one. But it's impressive to watch Philip Baker Hall work the set and work his magic as Richard Nixon. So it's on Criterion. I don't know if it's on the channel, and I don't know how readily it is. But look for Secret Honor. This was in the 1980s when Robert Altman was doing a lot of films based on plays and doing more low budget stuff. But man, it's a fascinating performance. So. Philip Baker Hall, salute to you. So, friends, thank you for listening. And until next time, go see a good movie you deserve. Wait, did I do that? Yes. Gosh, it's been a long week. So find some good movies, and we'll talk again next week. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!